This podcast is brought to you by the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania.
Well, renewable energy is an important part of our energy mix as we move forward. And the hope is that the investment in those arenas will also help control energy prices in the years ahead. Pleasure to be joined right now by Keith Fullenwider, who is chair of the law firm Vinson and Elkins. His firm very much in this space right now. Keith, welcome. Great to have you with us today.
Dan, thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Explain how your firm kind of has charted this path to be so much focused around renewables.
Well, Dan, our firm's been associated with the energy industry for a long time. We were involved in some of the development of the early oil fields, building of pipelines and power plants and energy assets throughout the firm's history. And the skill set you need to manage building a large solar array or large transmission system to accommodate wind power, help manage the price risks around energy projects, help manage the financing risks around energy projects, really transition very well to the renewable side. So for, you know, 20, 25 years now, our attorneys have been getting involved with the growing renewable power business, both in the U.S. and across the world. It's really been a great source of business for us, and I think our skill set translates well into the renewables world.
So where do we stand right now on the growth of renewables?
Well, spending is really quite incredible, and it's really accelerated a lot in the last two or three years. A Bloomberg report I was looking at this week, I think, said that across the world we spent about $1.8 trillion on energy transition investments last year, about $250 billion of that in the United States. The IRA has made a huge impact in the U.S. over the last 18 months. It really solidified the tax credits necessary and the way that we've chosen to sort of fund the build-out of solar and wind in the U.S., but it also opened up tax credits for a lot of other renewables technologies, as well as for carbon sequestration. And all of those are going to be important elements. That being said, we have a long, long way to go. You know, globally, we still get more than 80% of our energy from fossil fuels. That number hasn't moved very much in the last 20 years, despite the increase in focus on renewable investment. And that's just because we continue to use more and more energy across the world, both with things like developing economies, you know, wanting to put food on the table, lights on for their populations, as well as things like artificial intelligence, which are big, big consumers of power.
So if we've got that mix right now of about an 80-20 in terms of usage, realistically, what do you think the optimum scenario here is moving forward in terms of renewables' place in the overall energy mix? Is it a 50-50 ratio? Is it more than 50-50? Where do you think?
You know, the statistics can get kind of confusing about this because a lot of times people talk about the percentage of renewable energy. They're talking about the grid. And one of the real trends in the transition is to electrify things. And by electrifying things like transportation or like heating or cooling, you gain some efficiencies and you use less energy to cool through heat pumps or you use less energy overall to move around through electric vehicles. So some of the move towards electrification is a big part of the transition. When you talk about energy use on the grid, you're starting to see people talk about getting to something like 50% renewable energy in places like the U.S. over the next, you know, 10 years, maybe a realistic goal. But there's lots of other uses of energy, not just in transportation, electrification. There's industrial processes and agriculture and sort of the entire global economy. So to see something like 50% renewable energy use as opposed to electricity use is something that may take longer than that period of time.
Well, I mean, all you have to do is think about what the plans would be around chip manufacturing in this country over the next decade or two to realize that that there needs to be a ramping up around energy.
Yeah, you know, you saw this a little bit with crypto mining and the amount of power that began to get shifted towards that over the last, you know, few years. But AI really dwarfs it. There's an article in the front page of the Journal this morning from one of the chip makers talking about this. And you know, I think the hope is that AI will promise technology breakthroughs and innovation that will lead to more efficient uses of energy because, well, you know, we've gotten more and more efficient in how we use energy, but we still waste a tremendous amount of the energy that we you know, produce, combust, or produce through renewables means. So your hope is that AI will give you ways to use energy more efficiently. But in the meantime, just doing AI is an incredible source of power usage. There's one utility on the East Coast this past month that actually projected that we're going to use as much electricity for AI in the U.S. as we will use for the entire electric vehicle fleet if we're fortunate enough to meet some of our, you know, more aggressive projections for electrifying transport. And that's a pretty staggering increase in power consumption or power demand that just wasn't even there, you know, 10 years ago.
So then you're going to need to have a buildup of infrastructure in the years ahead, and a buildup in storage as well, in order to be able to meet a lot of those needs. And you know, what's interesting also about that is you know, where we are around electrified vehicles. We're in a time right now where there's a little bit of question about, you know, what the future of electrified vehicles is actually going to be because of the financial component for a lot of consumers right now.
Yeah, electrified vehicles are not getting cheaper anytime very quickly. They're still, I think, less than 2% of the vehicle fleet in the U.S. You know, vehicles in the U.S. last, you know, 10 to 12 years on average. So even if you crank up electric vehicle sales, you know, at a pretty rapid clip, it's going to take a while for them to get to, you know, sort of parity. It's going to take, you know, probably a couple decades. The charging infrastructure is something we've been involved in for some of our clients, just building that out across the U.S. and dealing with some of these longer haul, you know, trips. You know, I live in Houston. A lot of the electric vehicles that are being sold in the market right now, you know, won't get you to Dallas. And that's something consumers just aren't really that at peace with. So you'll see people willing to have one electric vehicle but wanting to still have a regular vehicle, conventional vehicle for their second car. It's going to take a long time to get to a place where EVs are, you know, majority of the fleet in the U.S. China is well ahead. Their introduction of EVs and charging stations is well ahead of the rest of the world, and it is actually pretty impressive. But you do need to tackle some of these charge point, you know, infrastructure issues that are going to make it, you know, convenient for people, as convenient for people as it is now to drive a car. And we've got a long way to go to see that happen.
How do the conversations around ESG kind of factor into what you guys are doing and what the expectations are around renewables?
I don't think there's any question, and I'm not sure I deal with anybody who's not focused on ESG and sort of just the doing right part of the energy transition. But it depends on where you are in the ecosystem and what your role is. You know, you were just quoting, you know, sort of a depressing small business index across U.S. small businesses. And for U.S. small businesses, you know, energy prices are a real factor. And for consumers and, you know, lower income, fixed income consumers, energy prices are a real issue. And I think to do the energy transition right, we have to be honest about what it costs. We have to talk openly about what it costs. The IRA, you know, is about $1 trillion a year investment on average. And it's had a tremendous impact upon the build out of solar and wind technology in the U.S. and will do that. But it does come at a price. And I think the policymakers, in addition to just, you know, doing a better job around permitting and reducing the inefficiencies around constructing some of these projects, do need to talk openly, honestly, with voters about the price of all this and what's a reasonable period of time to conduct the transition.
What about the financing components? I assume there's a fairly strong belief within the banking sector of the importance of renewables as we move forward here over the next several decades.
Yeah, you've seen, you know, tax equity continues to be the primary driver of investing in renewables projects in the U.S. That's because of the way we've chosen as a policy matter to want to finance these projects. And what really unlocked the things last year was the IRA provisions that provide for transfer of tax equity deals. That's really expanded the market because it's increased the number of people that can participate in these deals and made a lot more capital available, which is really necessary because the traditional buyers of tax equity were not going to be big enough to finance the build-out that's necessary. So the transfer markets are really opening up over the last 6 to 9 months, and that's a great thing for everybody involved. Banks do want to lend to projects, and unfortunately, they've also, in some cases, faced pressure not to lend on fossil fuel projects. I think that's regrettable because under any realistic scenario, you're going to need tremendous amount of investment in oil and gas, particularly natural gas, over the decades ahead in order to meet the overall energy demands of the world. And to sort of begin to pick technologies or maybe to demonize something like natural gas in the medium term as a matter of bank policy or ESG policy, I think is pretty misguided. And the effect it's going to have is going to be counterproductive because it's going to actually drive up the overall cost of energy, which is going to make it that much harder to transition to a more decarbonized world.
But then, you were kind of alluding to, you need to really focus on the regulatory side to make sure you have the right process in place in order to be able to get the best outcome longer term, especially on something like natural gas.
No, 100%. We've got to have government, you know, functioning. And when you've got, you know, tremendous gas resources in, you know, Ohio and Pennsylvania or in West Texas, and it becomes, you know, virtually impossible to get a new gas pipeline built, that's really not in the interest of the transition or consumers. And I think they're, you know, well-intentioned people who think that by trying to slow down the transportation or development of infrastructure around fossil fuels are actually helping the transition. I actually think, and if you live in the energy world, I think you see that's really not the case. They're really not in competition with the build-out of renewable technologies. It's just the reality that, you know, for many decades, we're still going to need natural gas for heating and for industrial processes and things that are that take longer to electrify. What you really want to do is make it as easy as possible to electrify as much as you can and use wind and solar to meet that increasing electrification demand. But you still need natural gas for a lot of other stuff. And making it harder and more expensive to do that doesn't make a lot of sense. The other thing that doesn't make a lot of sense is how hard it is to build transmission in this country. You know, we tend not to build cities in places that are incredibly windy. We tend to build them in places that are a little bit easier to live. And a lot of our wind resource is, you know, frankly, you know, out in the middle of nowhere. And we've got to have transmission build out in order to accommodate the solar and wind resources we're adding. And that's not part of the IRA. The IRA left transmission out, unfortunately. And you still really deal with state and local regulators when you're trying to deal with transmission build out. And our track record there is not great. So that's a place where we need government to do a better job of regulating with some common sense and making it easier to get the full transition done. And transmission is probably what people in the solar and wind business would tell you is the biggest hurdle right now.
Is truly solar and wind really the two areas that seemingly have the greatest benefit longer term in terms of the investment that you put in, but the benefit you could get out longer term of being able to collect that energy and use it as we move forward?
Well, solar and wind are just ahead of other technologies. And, you know, I think a lot of people who write and think about the transition are hopeful that there will be technology breakthroughs that allow other technologies, hydrogen, maybe direct air capture, carbon sequestration, things like that, to play a bigger role. But the energy transition is a game you got to play for the long run. You've got to do natural gas and storage. You've got to do solar and wind. You've got to look for technology breakthroughs. You have to do all of it. It doesn't serve, you know, serve us well to just focus all in on one or two areas. You really need all these forms of energy to be pushed forward to keep costs under control and to give innovation a chance to catch up. Again, I think people are very hopeful that AI is going to change the efficiency levels of the world in many, many interesting ways. And I think the energy industry is a place where that could really have a huge effect. It's too early and you can't really, you know, guesstimate where that's going to happen yet. So in the meantime, right, you got to do what you know you can count on, which is wind, solar, natural gas, storage, and those things. We're seeing a lot of interest in carbon sequestration. There's a Occidental Petroleum, Houston-based company, really leading the charge, doing a great job on focusing not just on sequestration in existing reservoirs, but also focusing on direct air capture. And I think given the pace and the need for fossil fuels to continue to be part of the energy economy, sequestration is a very important part of the mix here. You know, if we can pull some of the carbon from oil and gas out of the system and get it back into the ground, we can really help get to net zero and some of those goals much more realistically.
Let me go back and touch on AI for a second, if I can, because, you know, we're at a point right now where AI is this thing that pretty much everybody has heard about, and we're starting to see it impacting businesses, but we don't know to what level. Is it safe to say that that's kind of the where we stand around the potential of AI in and around the energy sector moving forward?
Yeah, I don't think we know much about the potential for AI in reality to reduce energy consumption or promote energy efficiency. I think what we can count about AI right now is how many chips and how many data centers and how much power it's going to take to do AI. And that's going to be a little bit scary. And it's not a reason to try to stop the future, but it is something that we need to plan for. And again, if you're an energy regulator, one of the things you have to keep your eye on is just demand and what the economy is going to need in terms of energy over the planning horizon. And that's what people who regulate electric utilities or regulate the transmission grid are supposed to do, and they've done a great job of that through our lifetime. We do have power outages and we do have problems, but we're entering a phase where things like AI are going to upset the models that these planners have used and create a lot greater risk that we're going to miss planning in terms of demand and end up with some things like you had some large weather events the last couple of years that caused real disruptions in power over a few days. We came very close to some grids or natural gas transmission systems actually collapsing and having to be sort of restarted, which would be a true economic disaster for a region if that took place. So, we talk a lot about investing in our infrastructure and, old parts of the economy that are maybe getting old or breaking down. One of those is demand forecasting, demand planning for electric utilities, and AI is something that is going to make that harder and harder for regulators to do.
Let me finish up on this, and I like to talk about topics also in the scope of how it's going to impact the consumer. When you think about what renewables could mean to the energy mix here in the U.S., what do you say to the average consumer about what they have to pay for power these days, or some of the other components that involve power in their lives and energy costs that they will be dealing with? What's the potential path that they will feel and see an impact from?
Well, that's a great question. It's really the essential issue, right? Energy, climate and energy transition are not the only issue. The real issue is, human flourishing and people, being able to live the lives they want to live and meet, pay their bills and feel like they've got economic opportunity in front of them. And the impact of energy rippling through the economy is tremendous. In the U.S., we've had a more balanced approach to energy over the last decade. It doesn't feel incredibly balanced right now, but if you think about the development of the resource in the Permian Basin in Texas or in the Marcellus and Appalachian region in the Midwest, we've been blessed with very ample supplies of gas and oil that have kept prices down in the U.S. way, way below levels that are paid for energy in Europe. You get the flip side in Europe where people decided they didn't want to be energy producers. They wanted to get all their energy from Russia or from other sources. I think a little bit of a short-sighted, maybe ESG mindset that sort of disconnected from reality. And you had people on fixed incomes in Europe seeing their electricity bills triple or quadruple over the last couple of winters, and Parliament having to provide bailouts and price controls and those kind of things, which are obviously only short-term solutions. If prices, the market's pushing prices up that much because there's a supply problem. And so we've been blessed with a more balanced view in the U.S., but policymakers have got to keep that in mind. And I think that's where we need government to work better. Government needs to forecast clearly. It needs to reduce the impediments to building new transmission and transportation. It needs to be as cooperative as possible with this infrastructure build out that's going to be necessary to power the country. And if we do those things well, then we can make the cost affordable to our consumers and small businesses. If we don't do them well, or we get a little bit too sort of misguided idealism around the pace of the transition, we can really hurt the average person and the average small business. And I hope we can avoid that in this country.
Keith, great to have you with us. Thanks very much. All the best to you, sir.
Dan, thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you. Take care.
You got it. Keith Fullenweider, who is chairman at law firm Vinson and Elkins. To explore more content from the Wharton School, visit knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu.